Welcome to Southern Steep, the public health and social justice podcast brought to you by NASDAQ, a nonprofit, nonpartisan association mission to end the intersecting epidemics of HIV, viral hepatitis, and related conditions. Much like brewing stronger tea, this platform aims to brew a stronger community by centering community leaders' voices and their innovative work in the Southern United States.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Southern Steep. Really, really excited today. I am one of your hosts, Bianca Ward, here with my amazing co-host and jack of all trades, Isaiah Webster. I know, you see how I did that? Look at your face. Hi, Isaiah.
Hello, Bianca. How are you?
I am doing really well. It's season two. When I was putting the arc together and we were preparing, I realized that this is our first episode in season two. Where have you been? Playing with the other kids?
So I did an episode with Nicole a few weeks back. I think it's going to come out right before this one. But that's been it. I haven't recorded with anyone else this season yet.
It's okay. You can just say that you miss me. Well, I'm glad we're here.
It's also the beginning of Black History Month, which I'm excited about, and I'm glad that we have a Black woman leader joining us on this episode. But I feel like time is flying by. I mean, this season is supposed to go until I think the end of March or April, and before you know it, I mean, that will be here.
Exactly, which means we still have to do more episodes together. Not to say anything else about our co-hosts. They really are fantastic. But, you know, I feel like we were, you know, originals. Speaking of amazing Black women leaders, I am super excited today to introduce our guest, Ms. Dafina Ward. I'm going to read your bio. So, one, I love reading the bios because it just, I don't think we get to hear how much amazingness that we've done. So I'm going to read your bio, if that's okay.
Go for it.
Okay. So Dafina Ward, JD, is an attorney and nonprofit strategist with nearly 15 years of experience addressing HIV and health equity issues in the Southern United States. Working in partnership with a range of advocates from grassroots leaders to federal decision makers, she is a trusted voice in regional and national spaces. Dafina currently serves as executive director of the Southern AIDS Coalition, an organization with a regional focus and national reach, with a mission to end the HIV epidemic in the South through a range of programs and initiatives across 16 Southern states and Washington, D.C. SAC utilizes community-centered policy advocacy, grant-making, leadership development, and capacity-building trainings to support transformation in the region. Just literally doing the work. How are you today?
I am humbled and excited to be here, but I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
What do you think when you hear your bio?
I think, wow, I've been doing this a long time. Mm-hmm. For a line of work that I don't want to say I fell into, but I was destined to come into, but it was not on my radar. To move into the work of HIV and health equity. I was an attorney. So I also describe myself as a recovering attorney because I was an attorney who was doing bankruptcies and landlord-tenant claims and all things not so fun and not focused on community upliftment and empowerment. And I wasn't fulfilled. And so I'm so thankful to be in this space and so thankful to still be working in this space. So excited.
That is a huge shift from bankruptcy and all of the lawyer legal work to HIV and your current position. So starting with that, how did you get into this work? What is your why story?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's there's so many levels to it. On a personal level, I was a new mom when I started in this work. And as I was practicing law and preparing for litigation, And I had a 2-year-old at home. And I said, this cannot be life. This cannot be what's keeping me away from her. And then when I became pregnant with my second daughter, I said, I want to do work where I can justify the time away from my girls. And that's really what happened. So I continued to practice law when an opportunity became available to do some consulting work around HIV prevention fundraising in Alabama. And I'm like, oh, I can do that on the side. That'll be a fun little feel good thing to do. And I just fell in love with it. So that's kind of the personal side as it relates to kind of the moment and the timing. But on a larger level, I'm a survivor of intimate partner violence. I was in a severely abusive relationship for years as an adolescent and young adult. And I often reflected on the long-term impact that had on me and also those things that could have happened as a result of that relationship and didn't. And one of those is HIV transmission. And I would often have those conversations with young ladies in my community around just all of those things we don't talk about, those variables of trauma and harm that we don't talk about. And so just realizing that there was work to do specifically around the needs of Black women in the South. And so it just felt like a calling. And lastly, when I was clerking at Southern Poverty Law Center as a law student, preparing to go out and practice law, one of the primary cases I worked on was a class action in a rural county jail in the Black Belt where a person could not get access to his medications for HIV. And that was my first opportunity to see what lack of access could do as it related to being engaged and retaining HIV care and all the systemic barriers that were in place and doing harms to communities most impacted. So it was just a lot of things that pointed me to this work. And I'm so glad that I listened when all of that came together. So
how do you think your experience as a lawyer has prepared you for your role now and the roles that you have had working in HIV?
I love that question. One of my board members calls me the expert communicator. And I think that really comes from being highly skilled in conflict resolution, also being trained as a mediator. And that also comes in handy a lot in the community, even before I came to SAC, in working in community spaces where there can often be conflict and just a lack of understanding and clarity, where we have a shared outcome that we want, maybe have different ideas around how we get there. And I think my legal training and experience has really been helpful in me being able to help to navigate those spaces, and to be a voice, maybe a peacemaking voice in spaces where there's understandable conflict, right, that's happening because there's so much on the line in this work. And it's so very deeply personal for all of us. I mean, some even more so than others. And so I think I really try to use those skills to listen and to create spaces where people can be heard and we can find a space where we can work together to get towards this goal of ending the HIV epidemic. And most importantly, doing that through a framework that lifts up and centers the experiences of people who are living with HIV and those communities that are most impacted.
That is really, really amazing and really, really thoughtful when you speak of just that skill of mediation. That's incredible. But also, I'm sure I as a parent also know that I have to be a skilled mediator between my two children as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because they will always try to get over.
I'm not as good with that one. That one's harder, especially now that my children are teenagers. And that is a different type of navigation and negotiation. And I feel, and I don't mean to get off topic, but it is just so timely, I think, in the midst of COVID and everything that we're facing, that our young people are facing, that there is just so much that preparing them around conflict resolution is so critical. And then helping them to navigate all the fields that are happening right now as well. So yes, to all of that, what you said.
So switching gears just a little bit and shifting topics, Dafina. So let me first note that Justine Ingram, who is a capacity building assistance specialist on your team, is actually a co-host on this podcast. Yes. And she has been working with us on season two. I don't know why Bianca didn't give her her flowers, but Justine, if you're listening, please make a mental note that I am honoring you today, even though Bianca didn't.
Justine is incredible. So Justine, blame the head and not the heart, darling.
But here's my question, Davina. So this podcast, we really try to center it on community-based organizations, ensuring their sustainability and their growth. And I want to start with the staff that you've been able to assemble, because as Bianca alluded to, we've worked with several members of your team. They're amazing. What golden nuggets would you share with other CBOs in the South as they think about how they wanted to go about attracting and retaining incredible and talented staff?
Ooh, wow. That is such a, first of all, thank you, all the flowers to all of my team, because they are incredible. And I know that Justine represents us so very well on Southern Steep and in all of the work that she does. You know, it really, I tell people I inherited some good people and then had the opportunity to recruit some good people too. And so I don't take credit for SAC finding all the right people, but I worked very hard for them to feel well supported so that they stay, because that is the key. A lot of folks are in this moment floating around, understandably trying to find a space where they can find purpose and be supported and valued. And that is the culture of the organization that we've built. So I tell organizations to make sure that your culture of inclusion, that your culture of acceptance, that it's actually not just reflected in some day-to-day practices that are not consistent, but that it's also reflected in your policies, that people see themselves and see their value in all aspects of your work. COVID has been tremendously hard for my team, just like it's been for everyone else. And we have created a culture of openness and transparency where if you need a day, you put it in Slack, I gotta take the day. I got to take the time. And I find that if you are respectful of what folks need in this moment that is so tremendously hard, they'll work hard for you. The work will get done, but you have to provide people with the space and the understanding. You know, I worked in a local CBO in Alabama for a long time, and there is so much talent in community-based organizations. Folks were on the front line doing the work. We often make the mistake of making people feel like they can only do this one thing. If I was hired in testing and counseling, then I'm gonna die right here in testing and counseling without the opportunity to explore what it might look like to work on the administrative side, to understand fundraising and development practices and financial analysis. And I think that it's so important for organizations to provide space for learning and growth. And that's something that we're being very intentional around. And lastly, I would say, don't be intimidated by difference. When you're hiring, don't worry about trying to hire the folks that in your mind fit the mold of what you need for the role. And I think we so often talk about, we need young people in the work. We need the young people. We want youth. And then as soon as a younger person or someone who's younger in the work maybe challenges a practice that we've had that's longstanding, we don't want to hear it. When they call out maybe systemic discrimination, systemic barriers we've created, then they become blackballed and we don't want to hear it. And I think we, as those of us in positions of leadership and decision-making, need to be willing to take a look at ourselves and to be honest with ourselves around how we might be perpetuating harm in our hiring practices. And that's why we're not retaining people. And if you're wondering why everybody's on the stand 3 to 6 months, stop looking at who you're hiring and look at your organizational practices and your policies that are making people feel undervalued or unseen or tokenized, which is so
100%. Awful. 100%. And I think, you know, maybe to use an imperfect analogy, there's always this feeling of, I know that you're a responsible babysitter. I know that you're high quality. I trust you. And this is my baby. And at the end of the day, should I call every 30 minutes? Is my baby really going to be okay? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes at work, when you've been doing it for so long, these projects, these things start to feel like your baby. Yes. And you're just not going to leave your baby with anybody. Even if you know in your heart of hearts that they're capable, you still worry. And I think that it's so hard to let go. But we have to let go, and we have to we really have to, if we're really saying, if we're going to hire someone because we think that they have an expertise that's value added, then let that expertise shine as opposed to not letting it shine. Mm-hmm. So I think, Dafina, that minority-led organizations, women-led organizations are important in any sphere, to be quite frank with you. But I think it's especially important in HIV work. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about the moment, if you can distill it down, to when you knew you were a leader. And before you answer, let me just give you a little bit of why I'm asking this question. So in our work, we often meet people. Bianca and I work on minority leadership at NASTAD, which essentially one of the things we do is work with health department staff to get them to kind of lean into their own leadership. And we often hear, we notice hesitation. We notice people kind of unwilling to lean in, but they have all the requisite skills. They like it's all there. And our role is just kind of bringing it to the forefront. Is there a moment, is there a time that you can recall when you were like, okay, I'm going to take this leap of faith. I know what I know. I have the confidence in self. I'm going to brand myself as a leader. And then my leadership is going to look like X. When I ask you that question, what comes to mind?
The first thing that came to mind was Dafina in the second grade on the playground.
Oh my goodness. We're going back.
And this little boy called me the N-word.
Oh no, ma'am.
And I knocked him off the monkey bars and he might have broke his nose. It wasn't my fault. But that is like when you said, when did you realize you were a leader? And I don't know if that's a healthy example, but that's the first thing that popped in my mind.
I had no idea you were going to go there.
Not just a leader, but a boss.
I'm just saying, we're not having that, right?
If y'all,
I'm sorry, but that was
if y'all having that, Dafina, she's quite professional and quite, you know, buttoned up. And I had no idea that she was going to say that.
So yeah, I took it all the way back to 8 years old. But more recently, you know what? I think for me, and I'll talk specifically around the decision to lead SAC, because that was a hard one. This was a hard decision. I've been at Southern AIDS Coalition since 2018, and I shifted into this role in December of 2020. So I was here for a while. We had a long-serving executive director, shout out to Nick Carlisle, who hired me and was here, and then he left, transitioned, and I served as interim for almost a year, hired another executive director, then there was a departure, and I'm like, I don't know if I want to be an interim. And then I said, you know, this is the thing I have to do. But I knew that because people I trusted told me that. So it wasn't just about, I knew that I had the skills, but it was something about people in the community living with HIV, who have been impacted by HIV, saying that they trusted me in this role that really pushed me to make the decision. And some of that is, might have been some imposter syndrome. We all have some of that. It's like, I think I can, but I don't know if I can do it well. And then, oh, it's a whole lot of responsibility and I got to be accountable. So there's all these things that swirled around, but there was so much power for me in hearing from others because, you know, leaders don't lead themselves and leaders can't, you know, I'm going to call myself a leader. It's just like people who call themselves allies. Like, it don't matter if you call yourself an ally, if the community that you're saying you stand up for doesn't see you that way, right? And so I think the same way around leadership is like there is so much responsibility. And I think any good leader is going to have moments of hesitation. And so because you have to reflect on the fact that you need to make an impact and that your role as a leader is to build more leaders. And so it's mm-hmm. like, what does that look like? But I'm so glad that I took that leap. I think I realized that I was a leader by nature when I was in law school. And there was some wonky stuff going on with grading in our legal research and writing class. And I organized the entire law school class and we had sections. That's how it is in law school. And so I organized and we did a petition and I had like 80 something percent of the first year law students sign off on this petition to get them to rework the scoring process for our legal research and writing class. And they did it. And I was like, oh, so that's, I can do that. Right. And it was interesting because there was a lot of different little contingents in our class who you wouldn't have think would unite around anything. But there was common ground there. So I was like, I might have a skill at this of identifying those spaces where you can bring people together and find common ground in a space where we can connect around something that is unjust and impacting it didn't impact everybody, but everybody knew it wasn't right. Right. And so I think that is really important, being honest in how you see yourself. And as a leader, like realizing that leadership does not mean you're perfect. It definitely means you're flawed. And I think too often people are made to feel like that you have to be infallible to take on these leadership roles, that you can't mess up, especially leaders of color, especially leaders of color, because I've seen some people in certain spaces who've done a whole lot of harm, who are not leaders of color, and continue to get opportunities over and over and over again. And yet I see a leader of color who may make a mistake, and they, and people make them feel like that's the end of the line. And they need to get out of the HIV field altogether, you know? And so I think we have to start calling that out too, and providing some space for grace and learning in these spaces for leaders.
So Bianca's going to ask you some questions about, you know, providing technical assistance in the South in just a second, but kind of like as a prelude to that, do you think that there's any nuance to being a leader in the South versus if you were doing this work in any other part of the country? In other words, do you feel like, how in your mind is your job different being that you are centered on the Southern United States versus if you were in, you know, I don't know, Minnesota, for just to use a random example?
Yeah, I think in a lot of our states, there's definitely some challenges around infrastructure. So there are things that I think folks maybe in other communities take for granted as far as having access to. I mean, one of those would be Medicaid expansion, because we know that most Southern states don't have that. And so just thinking about some basic, some things that people just maybe take for granted in other communities that don't exist here. Some of the infrastructure you may have in other spaces that we don't have here. Specifically around HIV, you're talking about basic things like comprehensive sexual health education that we don't have in many of our states. And so there's an uphill battle because of so many sociocultural things that play out in law and policy in the South that make addressing HIV even more difficult. I often, when I present and talk about our work, I use this map that the NAACP created back in 1908, this map of like where all the lynchings occurred over a decade in the United States. And then I overlay all these other maps. And so you start to see the same swath of states with all the same issues. And I'm like, well, that's the South. You know, there are layers and layers of barriers for folks here. And so I think that makes leadership here different. But I really try not to focus on, we know what the problems are. And so I try to get people to focus on this opportunity for solutions and this opportunity for building a new South, because I think it's there that we just have to acknowledging the past and what our barriers are is critically important, while also acknowledging that we now have a ripe opportunity to make things different. And so that's how I think about, that's the distinction that I reflect on when thinking about being a leader in the South. And I tell people, I love the South. I was born in Kentucky, grew up in Alabama. I live in South Carolina. And I love the region. And my husband jokes, he's like, we're gonna live in a blue state one of these days. Maybe so, maybe not. I don't know. But I love the South, and I love the people in the South. I love the warmth and the friendliness. And I think there's just a lot of education to do. But I believe change is possible. So
I love that you are already jumping ahead to the thing. So we're going to come back with what you love about the South. So hold on to that. But for folks who are listening who may not be familiar with Southern AIDS Coalition or the work that you all do, tell us about SAC in terms of, yeah, what you all do, who's your audience, what do you provide?
Yeah, so the Southern AIDS Coalition was founded a little over 20 years ago with the purpose of providing advocacy for Southern communities as it relates to making sure that the region was getting an equitable pot of resources for people living with and impacted by HIV. Because as you know, federal resources were very much at that time being allocated based on cumulative cases of HIV and AIDS. And so what we were seeing was that we maybe didn't have as many cases if you were going all the way back to the beginning of the epidemic, but we definitely had a larger number and growing number of new cases and of HIV and AIDS-related deaths happening in the South. And so it really was advocates. It was CBO leaders and HIV directors from state health departments and communities who were saying enough is enough and something needs to be different. And those advocacy efforts resulted in the formation of SAC back in 2001. So over the years, SAC continues its focus on policy and advocacy. And now we also are able to do grant making, as well as leadership development training, capacity building. We recently, in partnership with NASDAQ and other organizations, have started doing work with EHE jurisdictions around ending the HIV epidemic and doing technical assistance into public health entities that way. So I tell people that although we're an adult, if you go back to the formation of the organization, we're still like a preschooler when we look at like where we are currently as far as the current incarnation of Southern AIDS Coalition. And so we work across the 16 Southern states in DC. Most of our work is heavily centered on the Deep South. And I'm really working as part of my effort is to grow that, to make sure that we do have a presence and relationships across Southern states, because there's so much that Southern states can learn from one another. And our audience varies depending on our programming. We want to engage with individuals who are living with HIV so they feel supported and connected. Those providing direct services, those policy decision makers and entities, those who don't know a thing about HIV but are just now finding out that's still a thing. And in the South, because we hear that a lot. And so that's mm-hmm. who we are. And so we want folks to join us. There's membership opportunities, and we're in the process of revamping everything and doing our strategic planning and visioning process for the next 5 years. So I anticipate we're going to just continue to grow and evolve as well.
When you think of all of the work that SAC has done, the technical assistance, the capacity building, the policy making, the grant making, is there any particular initiative or area of focus or anything you all have done that you are most proud of or kind of tugs at your heart in a different way?
I'm proud of all of it, because I'm not going to be in trouble with my team.
My bad.
But you know what? I think one of the things I'm most proud of is that we were able to create Southern HIV AIDS Awareness Day. And so that was formed in 2019. And I always give props and flowers. So Aquarius Gilmer and Nick Carlisle, when they were here with us on our team, and we're very, very integral parts of creating SHAD, which is on August 20th. And I'm most proud that even during a pandemic, we only had one in-person event when we launched the Awareness Day in 2019. And since then, it's all been virtual, and it has just grown and grown. And I think what I'm most proud of about SHAD is that members of the community see themselves in that Awareness Day and participate. We've had dozens of organizations across the South and even national organizations sign on. And in 2021, the CDC actually began to recognize SHAD as a National Awareness Day. So I'm really proud of that, because at the end of the day, we want eyes and attention on the South. And while we are a regionally placed organization, we believe that if you can't end the HIV epidemic, if you don't end the Southern HIV epidemic. So if you want to change what happens in this country, eyes and energy and resources need to be fixed on this region. And so I think that makes me very proud. You know, programmatically on the day-to-day, I'm really proud of our grant making, because we have primarily funded organizations that are led by folks from communities most impacted by HIV. So we are funding primarily emerging organizations. For several organizations, we're their first funder. And that means a lot to us. And these are people who are doing the work already, who are running stuff around in their cars and giving people rides to appointments and doing the work, and just haven't had the capacity and the resources and need support around the infrastructure. So the Gilead Compass Initiative has really allowed us to grow that in partnership with other coordinating centers. And so I'm really, that goes to sustainability, and sustainability is critically important. So really proud of what's coming out of that, and seeing the growth of organizations you've probably, you know, very much heard of, but a few years ago had never had a grant. And so it's really exciting.
It's exciting to hear about organizations really putting money into community, into people, into passions, into meeting the needs of the people they serve. So that is wonderful. You mentioned briefly strategic planning. What would you like to see for SAC in the next, I was going to say 5 years, but let's even go a little further. Let's say 10. What would you like to see for SAC in 10 years? 10 years.
If they keep me around that long, let's see.
You better claim it.
I'm just kidding. I really would love for SAC to be seen as the convener of conversations around health equity in the South. I don't think we get where we need to go if we continue to silo HIV in these conversations. And so talking about HIV in the realm of just public health and general health, normalizing these conversations so we don't feel like we're always preaching to the choir, right? Where we have the programs and the same 100 people show up to everything that we do. I'll feel like we're successful when the general community is talking about their role in supporting people living with HIV, and we're testing, HIV testing is just a thing that everyone does, and where everyone has access to the healthcare resources they need. Now that's a big vision, but it's my hope that we can be a catalyst for change and a trusted resource to help to change what's happening in state houses across the South that may be continuing to pass policies and institute laws that are barriers to people that are living with HIV. So I want to see us be even more impactful at what we do on a grander scale. I want to see SAC, you know, we're looking at a new national HIV/AIDS strategy through 2025. And so we're working to develop what does that look like when you layer a Southern lens on top of that national strategy? What does that implementation look like? I want us to see that fulfilled, right? So my desire is that we just continue to have conversations in a way where other people can, where people can see themselves in our work beyond just who we're typically engaging. And I tell my, you know, my team that a lot. It's like, we're talking to the same people. We're not doing our job, or if we're not moving the dial, for folks. And I think that's often a, I don't mean to get off topic, but I know that's often a concern when you talk about HIV and direct service, where we say we want people to improve and we say we want folks to have more access, yet we can often be complacent if you see the same person in the same place for 10 years. So I do want to see SAC move. And I think that we have the ability to do that. And want it to just be a meaningful resource. I don't want us just to be a name, and I don't want us just to be a group of people that folks like. Like, I want us to be impactful. You know, it's fun to be liked, but I want us to make an impact, and that's critically important to me.
100%. You know, Gina Brown, who's on your team as well, she's spoken at numerous NASDAQ meetings. Mm-hmm. And when I tell you, whenever I see Gina, she makes the same point you just made about how we need to utilize people and make sure that they're not in these stagnant roles. They need to constantly be moving upward and forward. Like an upward trajectory is like core to almost every time I see her. Like if we ask her, Gina, come talk about race. Sure. Come talk about PrEP. Sure. But she always shoehorns into her remarks, mm-hmm. into her comments about how we need to be looking out for the professionalism of the folks we're working with. It is like, so as you were saying that, I was seeing her face, because every time she brings it up.
Gina is such a great example, because Gina is a trusted advocate, been in this work a long time. And since I've come to SAC, has shifted into a new role, right? She had been the community engagement manager at SAC for quite some time. And then looking at, you know, for so many people, Gina is seen as like an icon in this work around HIV advocacy. And within institutions and organizations, we need to respect this expertise that people bring and provide opportunities for elevation. And I think that's such, she brings that point up a lot, because it's true. People do get stuck in these roles. So now she's our director of strategic partnerships and community engagement, which is just a great fit for her because of all that she brings to this work. But yeah, people want to feel valued. They want to feel valued. And I think so often, you know, I tell my team, folks leave their jobs when they feel like they don't know what they're supposed to be doing. when they're not supported by their management and they don't know the measure for success. And if you don't know how you can do your job well, if that's not well articulated, you do feel stuck. Or if you feel like the expectations, nobody ever moves it forward, like the same expectation year after year without opportunities for growth. Everybody wants to grow. You know,
I want to ask you one question about COVID-19. So you kind of alluded to earlier how it's impacted some of the staff and kind of how they've been navigating that. And we've had those similar issues at NASDAQ. I want to know, you know, how it's impacted your work. So like, for example, we do a lot of trainings and meetings and kind of convenings, or at least we did. And then we went totally virtual for the past 2 years. And now we're just starting to dip our toes into this hybrid lake where, you know, it's part in person, part virtual. How has this pandemic really impacted, you know, the work that you all are doing and the work that you, more importantly, want to do?
Yeah, I mean, it's been tough, and it's shown up differently in different portfolios of our work. And so for our grant making, we adapted one of our funding opportunities. So while it was typically our small grant was focused on building community marketing strategies and what you put out into the world as far as events, we adapted it so that it could address isolation, so that organizations could get grants that focused on addressing isolation in communities most impacted by HIV. As a way of addressing stigma, right? And so recognizing that we had to adjust that way, we really had to shift to our being heavily reliant on our social media engagement pretty quickly. And so that's really, I think, where we've really been able to continue to engage the community throughout all of this. COVID has just been, it's been so hard on so many levels. And then and you layer on top of that, all the, you know, the racial injustice piece that's happened while we've been in COVID, and just the loss that so many people have suffered has just been tremendously hard. So I think as a leader, it's been a need to really balance programmatic deliverables with what I tell the team of, I just want to see us all get to the other side of this together. And so it's like that balance is so critically important. And so we've tried to carry that into our work with our partner organizations. So our technical assistance has been, how can we support you and how you manage your staff, you know, during COVID? Do you need some guidance around how to use social media and virtual platforms to engage your community? So the messaging has just had to change and be adaptable to the realities of what we're seeing happen on the ground. In the region, I think one thing that we really want to focus on is how do we help to get back folks back into testing, being engaged in testing and just these services that just have been really difficult for people to engage in. And we know in some communities, HIV testing dropped as much as 40 to 50, 60%, you know, so how do we get folks back into that practice? How do we offer and talk about at-home testing as a viable alternative? And there's just so many layers to it. So I think we've just been very flexible in our approach and trying to be responsive to what the community is saying that it needs during the pandemic.
If the pandemic has taught us anything, it is about flexibility. I think we were all going through our day-to-day lives, and then March 2020, everything was like, okay, sit down. And even when it's like, you know, feeling a little glimpse of hope or quote unquote normal, and then having to pull back and readjust. I think one of the things that I did see throughout the pandemic, especially here in this area in DC, organizations that I had worked with in the past, just seeing different approaches to social media, different approaches to outreach. I know one organization that was doing drive-through condom distribution. So you can pull into their parking lot and pass out. And like you said, the at-home testing. So it has definitely cause folks to think outside the box in a very different way. Some practices that will hopefully now live a long time when we start thinking about like telehealth and telemedicine. But at the same time, like you mentioned, isolation and the need for that community connection or that one-on-one connection, how do we bring that back safely? So this has been a learning experience, if nothing else. Clearly, we all need it.
And I think it's made us have different conversations around our workforce, too, because mm-hmm. we're always talking about this, you know, our workforce, the HIV workforce, like the workforce is tied. And so it's like, well, how do we take care of our people? How do we take care of the folks who are doing the work, who are trying to take care of communities? I mean, what we're seeing with healthcare providers, of course, mm-hmm. across the board. But I think if organizations are smart, they're taking some time to really reflect on how do their policies align with the needs of the people who are on their teams, because it's just really, this has been really tough. And this is also where accountability and expectations and all of that needs to be adjusted where it can be, and it needs to be made clear, you know, because folks don't need to feel like it's a moving target, you know, right now. It's just really important. We started utilizing a self-care app that we got for everyone on our team, the Shine app. And so we've started utilizing that and encouraging our partners to do that. Like, get the Shine app for your team. It's a daily meditation, all the beautiful things, you know, created by, you know, an inclusive and diverse group of, you know, therapists and professionals of color. So just thinking about different things you can do to let your workforce know, we know this is hard and mm-hmm. we appreciate you pushing through at this time. And then giving people permission to say when they can't push through.
Yes. Absolutely. I love that. As we wrap up, we have a few questions that we ask all of our guests. So it is a two-part question. What do you, and you alluded to some of this before, but now this is your time to really just pour on all the flowers of the South. What do you love about the South? And what do you want to see for the South?
I love people that say y'all. I love, I live in the low country of South Carolina. So we have the moss hanging from the trees, which I just absolutely adore. I love that people smile at each other when they pass each other in public and acknowledge one another, which I think during a time of isolation means a lot for folks who maybe are alone most of the time. People tend to speak to you in the South. I like that we typically say what we mean, even if what we're saying is just a hot mess. We tend to kind of just say what we mean. I love my people. I mean, I just think that there is just something, there is just a beautiful thing about Southern communities. There is so much here that needs to improve, but there's so much that's beautiful. I mean, if you just drive through the South, it's so beautiful, from mountains to beaches and everything in between. So, you know, those are the things that I love. And I live in a community that is rural, but it don't know it's rural. Like, we think we're a city, but we're really not. We live outside of Hilton Head Island. So between Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. And we think we're Beverly Hills. We're not. So it's just really interesting. Just the diversity of community, in the South, I just really adore. So yeah, I love this region and I love the people here. So.
And what would you like to see for the South?
I would like to see the South be open. I would like to see the South be more open to new ideas and new approaches. I would like to see the South embrace all of its children. I would like to see the South in the centuries old need to create barriers to people enacting basic civil and human rights. I'd like the South to get out of other people's business. Stop worrying about who's sleeping with who and who. Just let people be. I think that's we're too nosy. Just get out of folks' business and let everybody have what they need to be healthy and free and liberated. But I want to see our schools transform. I want us to not ban books because we're scared of people learning. There's just so much I want for this region that I think is possible. I want us to stop running off talent. That's a short list I want it to be a region where my children will want to live after they complete high school and not feel the need to run away from. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially that last part. I know a lot of people who, yes.
Yes.
Lived in the South and then they were like, okay.
I'm out.
And I'm out. Right. Right.
Yeah.
But then perhaps later in life return. So yeah. Something draws them back for mm-hmm. sure. So this has been wonderful. How can people get in touch with you, learn more about SAC? What's the best way for folks to do that?
Yeah, just please visit our website, www.southernaidscoalition.org. Follow us on all the social media channels. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And if you go to our website, you can shoot us an email and we can connect, and we'd love to connect with you. You can click join the movement and you can give, or you can become a member. And that's what we want people to do. And if this is going to be airing sometime during Black History Month, and y'all can edit this out if it's not, but if it is, we're going to be collecting information from folks. We want to know how folks are doing Black wellness, because it is Ooh. Black History Month's theme is Black health and wellness. And we want to know what that looks like for folks in our community. So follow us on our socials and tell us how you're doing Black wellness as we continue to fight to take care of each other, to end the HIV epidemic in our community, and make sure that those who live with HIV have everything that they need to be healthy and to thrive. So
I love it.
Love that. How are you doing Black wellness? I'm going to start asking my friends that. That is a real question. That tapped my soul.
Awesome.
Thank you. I have to go ask myself that. Bianca, how are you?
Every day. And, ask myself that every day.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership and your vision and your support of a truly awesome staff, because you work with some really incredible folks. And thank you for doing the work, for knowing that you are a leader since you were 8 years old and blessing us with your gifts.
I can't thank you enough. This space is affirming and wonderful. And I can't say enough about my team and our board for allowing us to have the vision and to do the work, supporting us and not trying to hold us back. And that means a lot in this work. So thank y'all so much for this space. This was great.
You're quite welcome. Good to see you. Take care. We will talk to you in down the line.
Sounds great. Thanks, y'all.
Bye. Thank you. Bye. For this episode's edition of Southern Charm, we highlight PALS in Columbia, South Carolina. PALS Inc. was formed in 1985 to help South Carolinians fight the war against HIV/AIDS and offer free services to people who have been diagnosed or at risk of contracting HIV/AIDS, including working with their loved ones. PALS provides a myriad of services from HIV testing, STI screening, and hepatitis A and B vaccination to support services for people living with HIV, such as case management, support groups, and emergency financial assistance. What I love about PALS when I was reading about this organization is that they're very intentional about also providing support for caregivers with loved ones who are HIV positive, which I don't know if I see very often or very deliberately. So kudos to PAL for not only caring for the community they serve that are living with HIV, but also those who are impacted and caring for their loved ones as well. To learn more about the extraordinary work happening at PALS, and that's PALSS, visit www.pals.org.
I love it. What a great choice, Bianca Ward.
Why, thank you. This was a wonderful episode. It's good to be with you again.
It is great to be with you, Grant. I feel so privileged to have had a chance to talk to Dafina. She really does bring the eye-opening wisdom. There's a few things she shared with me today that's gonna have me thinking for the next couple of days.
Literally, I am now going to advocate for the Shine app. for all the folks. But I love that she is very clear about the way she cares and supports her team. I think that says a lot about leadership and what a great leader does. So thank you again, Dafina, for joining us and being amazing.
Absolutely amazing. And thanks to you for listening to Southern Steve. You can learn more about the podcast and about all of us by going to our website at nasdaq.org, and you can find the podcast at the CBO Hub there. I am Isaiah Webster.
And I am Bianca Ward. Thanks for listening.